It's a bloke playing records and talking crap. That's all you do. You can kind of own a city on radio that you can't ever do on television. Well, I always reckoned if I was parked up when the news jingle was playing, I was all right.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we hear from those who made a difference. Chris Tarrant.
I grew up with a very proud ex-soldier as my dad, a lovely, cuddly mum. And it was just that world where the bloke goes out to earn some money and make money for the family, and the wife stays at home, and it's sort of laughed at now, whatever. But it was a pretty stable environment. Then I went to school around Reading for a while, then he sent me off. They kept sending me away. He packed me off to Worcester for 4 years. It was quite fun. I listened to lots of radio, because really, I mean, certainly early years, there wasn't telly. There was no telly at all. So I listened to lots of radio. And it was that lovely thing that nobody does anymore, where the whole family would come together at lunchtime and we listened to radio. We listened to, Beyond Our Ken, which was just wonderful, and Hancock, and programmes like that. And we just sat there glued. We sat there glued to a radio ventriloquist. My dad used to say, even on radio, I can hear his lips move. It was truly dreadful, but it bonded us as a family, and I think we've lost all that now.
Now, Archie, I want you to behave yourself in here, my boy. Don't speak until you're spoken to, understand? This is a club for gentlemen.
Don't worry, bruv. I won't give you away.
But I had no thought at that time at all of ever going into radio. And I kept, purely coincidentally, I kept being dragged back to the Midlands. So the best option, I was sort of offered a place at Oxford, but I had to wait around for another year, and I was a very impatient young kid. So I just went to University of Birmingham for 3 years. So everything was back to the Midlands. You know, I was at school in Worcester, I was at university in Birmingham, and then the first proper job I got, I did all sorts of strange jobs, you know, factory guard and things. Bricklaying, hod carrying, lorry driving, which I loved. But the first proper job really was when I got to ATV in Birmingham. You know, I worked on the sort of current 6 o'clock news show, current affairs show. And I just loved it, but I wasn't actually much good, which never seems to surprise anybody. I really wasn't, because I was trying to be every sort of ITN reporter. I interviewed politicians, local politicians, mayors, shop stewards and stuff. And I just didn't like them. And I didn't have the ability, which a lot of people do have, of pretending they're making a perfectly valid case and liking them. I just thought, you know, you're a Lord Mayor, or you're a shop steward, or you're a local, you know, MP or whatever, and your lips are moving, and I know therefore you're lying. I still sort of believe that. But luckily for me, they gave me the... They thought, this bloke with a very long blonde hair, it was a long time ago, they thought, this bloke's actually quite fun and is quite good, but is not at all good at, you know, the sort of hard news stuff. So I became the sort of our man interviewing local lunatics, which I loved. So I started doing the upside down beer drinker, the man who ate live goldfish. I do remember interviewing a man who for 4 days had a pigeon on his head. He slept with a pigeon on his head. I interviewed a man in the Black Country who had a Shetland pony. I do remember vividly interviewing a man who walked from Worcester to Evesham, a distance of some 13 miles, with 4 live ferrets down his trousers. I was crying with laughter. The real reason I remember this, apart from it was just a gruesome piece of tea time television, my dad and my mum lived outside the ATV Midland area, and they'd hired a room in a hotel in Oxfordshire, Woodstock, to actually go and see their boy for the first time on television. And I think they thought I was some sort of hard news, you know, Trevor McDonald or whatever, Mark Austin. And there's this buffoon wandering along the road, crying with laughter, with a man with 4 ferrets down his trousers. But they were great days.
What does it feel like? Aren't you, uncomfortable? Aren't you being bitten?
Not yet, no.
But they've got the sort of tooth that hang on, haven't they?
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Is he still hanging on?
Not quite, no.
And this morning you stuck 4 down. Probably on Sunday you'll only use 2, I think, if you've got any sense.
Well, I've got a lot of sense. I mean, everybody makes a fool of themselves one time or other in their life.
Is it more difficult for them if you're moving? Yeah,
well, and I'd been doing ATV Today for a couple of years, and they said, we've got this little Saturday morning programme, we're trying to get off the ground. We think you'd be ideal. And it just changed my life. Tiswas grew, I think, as we grew. I mean, we were kids. You know, we were just being silly, really. I mean, it's almost a continuation of university. When we started, we had no budget at all. There were two presenters, me and a nice guy called John Asher. We only had one seat. It sounds unreal now. For us to literally change seats so that I got into the seat and John got out, we used to put up a caption. And then while the cardboard was up on the screen, I would, you know, jump across my seat or whatever. I was flourishing myself with daft ideas. Peter Harris, the producer, was also mad as a trumpet. He went on to do the Muppets and all sorts of things. So we were quite daft. We just had a silly sense of humour. And then the buckets came in and the pies and all that. And then, I suppose then we thought, well, this is so successful, you know, we can't just two of us changing behind a bit of cardboard. I got in Sally James because we needed a female presence. It was very blokey. And she was quite blokey, actually, anyway, bless her, in her leather jacket. And I wrote a sketch about Muhammad Ali. And I'm saying in the office, I need to find somebody who does a Muhammad Ali impression. And they're going, oh, God, we don't know anyone and all this. And I did a really bad one. I thought, well, I don't want to do this, I don't think. And somebody said, there was that kid who won New Faces, Lenny Henry. And I said, oh, yeah, he's good. What happened to him? And I said, don't know, he's completely disappeared. And I found out that Lenny, this sounds surreal now, Sir Len, was appearing in the black and white minstrel show at the end of the pier in Great Yarmouth. And he was the only one who didn't have any makeup on. I mean, it sounds daft, but that's actually what he was doing. And I went to see him. I sat quietly in the audience. I thought, well, I'll go and chat to him backstage when he finishes. And his flies burst. And everybody is falling about with laughter. Well, they're doing quite a straight song, and I'm thinking, oh. And I actually thought, this is obviously part of the act. And I went in the dressing room with this, oh, hi, Lenny Henry, I'm Chris Tarrant and all this. And I said, that bit with your flies. He said, no, that's not supposed to happen at all. It was awful. I was so embarrassed and all this. And we just struck up a friendship. And I said, would you come and do this Muhammad Ali? And he was like, oh, God, I don't know. He had no confidence. It seems extraordinary now. He had no confidence at all. And the guy just grew and grew and grew. I mean, he's amazing all round. Great bloke. Good fun with us. We had wonderful days doing Tis One.
It's really wonderful to be back on Tis One, and it's just nice to know that they haven't reverted back to their old ways of throwing buckets of water after each newsflash. Thank you.
I continue doing ATV Today 5 days a week, and Tis One's on the Saturdays. For an extra £25, I remember, live for 3 hours. That seemed quite good then. And there was a period they said, look, you've got to make your mind up, you know. They talked about a credibility gap, which is probably very true. So it was, you've got to make your mind up, you know, do you want to do the bus crash or do you want to do buckets? And I thought, well, it's buckets for me. And then I took over as producer, so Tiswas then became my life. And it was my life. I mean, I loved it. We had such a laugh. And we were pop stars. We were actually mobbed. You know, wherever we went, we were pop stars. We were signing autographs. We were opening shops and everything. And, you know, making a reasonable amount of money. But mainly just having such a laugh. The whole country took Tis One slowly over a couple of years. They all came in, except London. London were very sniffy. And when we finally got London Weekend agreed, well, it's got this massive audience and this and the other, we better take this thing. I mean, it just went through the roof in London, and we were sort of, you know, megastars in town. I also, for the first time, and it's a sniffy London sort of thing, I started to get complaints and dreadful articles written in, you know, in silly newspapers in London, saying, get this man off our television, you know. I remember one was, he suspends children by their ears. I don't hang them off. Their feet don't actually leave the ground. I mean, we always used to think. That purely started because you get a sweet little kid would sit next to you and say, right, do you want to say hello to mummy? And they'd always look the wrong way. So that we had to get away and gently, that's it. So come on then, up by your little ears and we're pointing you gently towards the camera. This became the sort of Chris Tarrant, you know, mistreats children. And all that stuff, and throwing buckets of water over women with their best clothes and all that. Which is fun. That's all it ever was. It was a hoot. There are now, so that you can get a university degree, I think, into it. It is so analysed now. And it was just a load of guys and one girl being very silly. That's all it was. But I did 7 years of that, and by the end, I think we just got fed up with it. I mean, it sounds silly, because I did love it, but by the end, I thought, we're going nowhere, and I'm going to end up like Mr. Pastry, that man rolling about in custard when he's 61 or whatever. And we all decided to move on.
Anyway, that's all from me. Thanks very, very much for being a smashing audience over the years. We go over now to ITN for the lunchtime news headlines. Cheers. Ta-da. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And then we did this late-night thing, OTT, which was... I remember it now with great fondness, but at the time it was pretty rough because I used to be the producer And every Monday morning I'd be dragged into the controller's office and kicked all around the carpet. But it's good days, you know, it's great days. I had no interest in radio whatsoever as a career. I thought, I don't know anything about it, you know. And I did a book called Ken's Furry Friends. It was just about silly stories. Ken's Furry Friends was about a bloke with rats down his tights. And he was a sort of dancing rat. He was actually a rat catcher, and he danced on stage in OTT with people squealing and lots of complaints because he just filled his tights with rats, and they were live rats, and it was all very well. And a lovely guy on Radio Mercia said, would you come up? I did some interviews all around the regions about the book, as you do. Then this nice man called Jim Murray from Radio Mercia in Coventry. I did an interview with him, and he said, would you come back and do a Christmas Day special? And I went, oh, stuff that, I'm not doing Christmas Day. He said, no, we can pre-record it. I said, well, what do we do? And he said, you just sit there and tell, you know, 10 silly stories from your book, and I will put in 10 records. You can choose 10 records, sort of, for Christmas. And it was fun, and I enjoyed it, and, you know, he said, no, it's a really good programme, and you know what. What I didn't know was that those sort of things get syndicated. So unknown to me, I mean, it's fine by me, but unknown to me, all these other stations took this 1 hour of Tarrant rambling on about Ken's Furry Friends, whatever. And one of them was Capital Radio, which I knew nothing about except Kenny Everett, who lived not far down the road from me. He worked there sometimes, I think, you know, I thought. And they wrote me a letter, and I passed it on to Paul, my agent, and I said, look, I don't know, I think, you know, I had a nice time being interviewed. I don't know anything about radio, and really I'm doing TV, and I was then working for the BBC for a while. And they sort of persisted. A nice lady called Jo Sandland, she sort of persisted. And I said, well, you know, I don't do radio, I don't understand radio, get me suit on and do telly sort of thing. And they kept on and on. So I went down, I did a pilot. I came in on a Sunday with a pile of records, and I did a pilot, which apparently was quite well received. I did the pilot, and they offered me a Sunday show. And I didn't want to do it, to be honest. I wasn't that keen. I didn't, you know, it was a nice experience. You know, it was a one-off. I didn't want to be tied every Sunday going to London or whatever. So I still lived in the Midlands. And in the end, Paul, my agent, is saying, look, they're offering quite a decent amount of money. It's only one day a week. They have given you every conceivable out to pre-record if you can't be there on a Sunday or this or that and pay your train fare or whatever. He said, if you don't do it, you're daft. And I went, yeah, all right, well, go and do it. And I did this thing catchily called Lunday Sunchtime. Laugh. I can't believe we got away with this crap. And I did that for about a few months. And then it became complicated because then they offered me a daily show. I did this thing between 11:30 and 1, which is a slot that doesn't really exist on any radio station. I was before the splendid Roger Scott, and I was after, I think Mike Aspel was still there then for a while, and also Lulu. I mean, it's a weird mixture of people.
It's the Chris Tarrant Show on Capital.
Short tops, Bernadette. 6-1 here on Capital. Chris Tarrant cleaning things up for Roger Scott. Bernadette! The chart rockers, the Cult Group, are going to be paid with tractors when they play in South Korea. Currency restrictions...
But anything I wanted to do, like TV stuff, they said take a week off or pre-record or whatever. They were very laid back about me continuing my career, which I still saw as my main job, being on the telly. But radio was sort of a source of fun. And then slowly I thought, do you know, I love this. This is so nice. Bear in mind, the TV time, we had an awful lot of union problems. It was, I mean, how we ever got Tiz was out most weeks. There were so many objections. You know, you can only have 1 inch of water in a bucket and somebody has to come with you to hold your hand. And there were so many people, you know, God knows what most of them did, wandering about studios, getting in the way. And it was a really heavy union shop. We had a 3-month ITV strike. And I thought, radio, I just come in with a pile of records. Nobody says, what are you going to do? Nobody asked me. I just sort of wittered on, played a bit of Pink Floyd and went home. Capital quite well off. So I just seemed to remember getting quite a lot of money to do an hour and a half a day. Capital was a tip. I mean, it was this legendary commercial radio station. You would sort of trip over records everywhere, and it was just a mess that sort of be. It was nothing like the massive corporate giant it became. There were just people wandering in, Kenny Everett would come bumbling in with an LP under his arm. It was just so laid back. And actually, there was just a book, which wouldn't happen now. There was a book, and you wrote down what records you wanted to play, and that was it. Nobody else said we're not playing that because it was played again 2 hours before or 2 hours after or whatever. All that stuff just didn't happen. But it kind of worked because actually the people they used were very good. I mean, this thing now about rotating records and all that, which drives me personally up the wall, where they play the same record day after day after day after day. And I think it's killing radio. But DJ free choice sounds a wonderful thing. I mean, I had quite a lot of lassitude at Capitol to, you know, to choose quite a few of my own records. But I'm not an idiot, and I sort of had, I'm very self-controlled, I suppose. I mean, I just remember dear old Roger Scott. He was, you know, was a wonderful disc jockey, a great voice, and a really bright, intelligent man. And he loved Bruce Springsteen. He was obsessed with Springsteen. I mean, we used to take the mickey out of him mercilessly because he loved Springsteen so deeply. And Roger came in one day. There was a famous Wembley live concert of Bruce Springsteen that came here, rocked the city, and he did a three, which is a very long concert, and he really put the hours in and really, you know, so energetic. And he did just over 3 hours, and the album became the Bruce Springsteen 3 hours live at Wembley album. Roger Scott came in one day, a second after two, said, yeah, Roger Scott here on Capitol Radio, whatever. This is the best concert I've ever been to. Put the album on and just sat there, smoking, because you could smoke in studios there, and drinking coffee. So he just played Bruce Springsteen for 3 hours. And I think by about an hour, even Bruce Springsteen was throwing himself on his own sword. And that is where own choice DJ, all DJs want to choose all their tunes all the time. But mainly that is, that is a bit excessive. My boss was Joe Sandilands. Joe Sandilands was the controller. She plucked me from this Radio Mercia tape, and she sort of guided me through for 2 or 3 years because, I mean, she was the one who said, I would really like you to do the breakfast show. And I went, I don't want to be getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning in the dark. I can't believe that. You know, and I was really like, that's too much. And by then I was doing a lot of telly. I thought, I can't do all this. It's too much. You know, I was married. I had young kids. I thought, I don't want to be getting out of bed when it's dark and all that. So 17 years later, when I finished the breakfast show, I owe Joe Sandilands a lot. I also owe her a lot because Joe actually married David Briggs, who became a very major part of my life, one of my best friends. We're sort of like, we always think in the same terms and whatever. Because he produced the breakfast show for 15 years, he was my producer. David was a great catalyst, actually, because not many people have actually produced me. I've had producers who are friends, mainly Tiswas. I mean, I produced the show and Lenny and Sally and everybody else. I sort of know what I'm best at. David was very good with me. He would say, that's boring. David and I used to sit and talk about me like a lamb chop. We would actually talk very objectively about this commodity called me. And, you know, he could be as unkind and rude as he liked. I would never take it personally and go, no, come on, I wasn't that boring. Yeah, you were. You were really boring. David and Joe Sandilands have been to America on a fact-finding tour. They came back and got married, so I don't know what facts they found. But they went to this wonderful place called Film House. They made TV commercials for radio stations. All over America, and we were the first one to do it. We brought commercials. I shot over there with Briggsy. You do about 16 commercials in a night sort of thing. This ridiculous work ethic over there, but it was great. So when the show started, we had commercials already ready. And the whole zoo format, as Americans called it, meant basically lots of people talking at once if you're not careful early in the morning, which can be incredibly irritating. If it's done well, though, it is brilliant. And nobody did it. All British radio stations, commercial or BBC, had one man talking, or one woman, mainly one man as well. So the idea of me with several other people, the Flying Eye, Cara, the Weather Girl, the news guys, all being part of a gang, as opposed to over to the traffic, do the traffic, don't say anything, and then back to me, over to the news, whatever you do, don't say anything to the newsman, come back to him. That all went out the window. When that works well, it works wonderfully. And nobody had heard anything like it in this country. Nobody had heard it. It only works when the guy in the middle, or the girl in the middle, has control. And the guy in the middle has got to have total control of everybody else's microphone and tell them when to shut up, because you've got all commercial things going on, you've got breaks to go to and whatever. They have to like each other as well, I think. There are famous radio shows I know of. I know one well-known breakfast show where the two presenters absolutely loathe each other, and while the record's going round, they just literally do not speak. And then it's coming out of the record. Well, that was marvellous. I mean, I could never do that. I can only work with people I like, to be honest. I mean, you really, God knows, you know. I think that's why, I mean, for me, the Capital Breakfast Show, which was, what, 17 years of my life, it was great fun. And we were mates. We were close mates. Because you're thrown together in this horrible environment. It's dark, it's cold, it's wet. You've had a row with your missus. You've fallen out with your, you know, your boyfriend, da, 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 da. And you're all thrown into this environment, and it does become a gang. You know, we travelled the world together, and we had such a good time. People always used to say, "You and Briggs are inseparable. You think like each." We actually do. He went off to see if he could do television, because he the first thing he did at Capital once he got settled, he sort of started investing in for the company in radio sponsorship, which he'd never heard of then. You go back to the early 80s, nobody had ever heard of that. You know, by the end, Capital Breakfast Show was sponsored by Kellogg's Corn Flakes and all that. And Briggsy started all that stuff. And then he went across to television, which is a big, bad world he didn't really understand. And he struggled. He actually struggled. He was working, but he wasn't enjoying it much. And I used to take him out for lunch once in a while, and this and the other, just to keep him happy, really, because he's a mate. And then he said to me, he said, "You know that thing? We did a competition on the radio called Double or Quits." And he said, "You know that Double or Quits thing we did?" And I said, "Yeah, I enjoyed that." He said, "Well, I'm trying to make a TV format of it, you know." And I said, "I'll be honest, Dave. I was doing Tarrant on TV and loads of stuff. I had a lot of telly going on, and the radio." And I said, "Dave, I haven't got time to take on any more telly." He said, "No." He said, "But if I do a pilot, would you just come and do the pilot for me? It's a sort of one-off thing, because I just want to get it established. I've got this TV idea, this TV format. You know, would you come and do it if I ever get, you know, ITV to or anybody to agree to it?" So I said, "Yeah, I'll do the pilot. I don't want to do a series." So we did this pilot thing, and I thought, "Yeah, I quite like this, you know." Wasn't particularly excited, but I thought it was quite a nice idea, and sort of good luck. And he said, "Well, they'd really like you to do a series." I said, and I remember this, I said, "I don't know, I don't really want to do a series. And to be honest, I can't see this programme ever catching on. This little thing that they changed it from Double or Quits. They actually changed it from Double or Quits to Cash Mountain. And then they sound, that was a bit of a naff title as well, which it was. And then they wanted to change it to Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And I did famously say, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire is a stupid name, and that's never going to catch on. Rather like the man at Decca who turned down the Beatles. What did I know? And it took over my life again. I did that for 15 years, and it sold to 120 countries around the world. And David Briggs, who was struggling, is now the richest man on the planet, etc., etc. The story is legendary. But Dave Briggs was a very, very important part of my career. And actually, one of my best friends. But also, you know, it's all that if. But the world is like that. If Jo Sandler's hadn't picked up the tape, if she hadn't married David Briggs, who knows? I'd be digging holes. 95.8
FM. Got a great new system this one. We've got three clocks, all with completely different timings on them. It could be almost anything. It's sometime between 8 and 9 now here on Capital. I think it's 12 minutes past 8. I'll just blow the dandelion. Hang on. Yes, it seems to be 12 minutes past. Here's a girl having the honeymoon of a lifetime.
I was once introduced at a radio conference by Paul Jackson, who was Richard Park's son, as the only man who ever told my father to fuck off in the studio, which is a true story. I actually had a very good relationship with Park. He kind of left me alone, but not in a creepy way. He just said, "I think you know what you're doing, Chrissy." I mean, Capital at its peak was just colossal. You know, it just went through the roof. This sounds a bit grand, but it's true. You can kind of own a city in a way on radio that you can't possibly ever do on television. So even at his peak, you know, he wouldn't say, I don't know, Bruce Forsyth owned London, you know, Anton Deck, whatever. Radio gets into people's souls. And there were several years when I just owned London. I was the best known man in London by miles. And the same way that Les Ross just owned Birmingham. Rick Dees in Los Angeles. What did you hear what Rick said this morning? Scott Shannon in New York. It's a great buzz. Richard Park used to do these tedious meetings with graphs and things, most of which I used to avoid. But there was one where the Capital Breakfast Show's audience was bigger than all the other radio stations' breakfast shows put together, including dear old Terry Wogan, bless him, my mate, and Evans and whatever. It was just enormous, and the shares went through the roof, and all the executives, you know, made lots of money and all that. It was huge. It just struck a chord. God, we love this. It's part of our lives. Michael Crawford came over once to do an interview. You know, they said to me, look, don't do the Frank Spencer thing, because he's very much a big Broadway star now, musicals and all that. And he walked in and went, Chris, lovely to see you. And he said, when I get back to London and I turn my radio on, if you're not on the radio when I wake up, I just feel crap all day. And I now can relate to that, because I went to Los Angeles and Rick Dees was on holiday. And I was this lost soul wandering around the streets. It is a weird thing. I mean, Evans may have achieved it as well up to a point, but it's just a weird thing. Les Ross was just a god in Birmingham. And yet, he'd never come down to London. Nobody knew him from Adam. And the good thing about Les as well is that most people didn't know what he looked like.
I only fall over a few times when I'm dancing. That's the happenings there. I love that song. I don't think I've played that on the air before, but anyway, I've played it now. A little bit of girth.
It's much better if you don't know what the person looks like. I mean, nowadays all the media stuff want to know what people look like. Howard Hughes became this sort of, hello, Howard Hughes here. And women used to drool over this voice. Oh, I bet he's so handsome. Oh, I bet he looks like Brad Pitt. Then he would appear and they go, oh, bless him.
Capital reports at 9. RMT chief Jimmy Knapp says nothing can stop tomorrow's 48-hour train strike, and he's sure none of his members will cross picket lines. The two sides in the signal row have...
Nowadays, you know, they do webcam. I was so anti-webcams. I just said, it's radio, guys. We're not on telly. Stop doing this. And I would hang my coat over the webcam. The first thing I did in the morning, I would hang my coat over the webcam and I would light up a cigar. You cannot do those things now. And I understand that. You know, people didn't want to follow me with a cigar. But we all used to. Cara would sit there smoking. Annie, the producer, there'd be ash everywhere. Wogan on the other side of town is smoking a big cigar and all that.
Some people still don't know how easy it is to win free money in the Capital Radio Birthday Bonanza. No tricks, no stunts, no silly gimmicks. Just tune to Capital Radio 95.8 FM, then listen at 8.15 Monday morning. I'll announce the birthday in this envelope. If it matches yours and you can answer the birthday question...
We did lots of sort of radio quizzes, some of which were very funny, actually very clever. Briggsy, Dave Briggs, came up with all those sort of ideas. The Birthday Bonanza thing, I mean, that came from America. And it was, don't forget, tomorrow morning, 8.15, I'll open an envelope. Inside that, if it's your birthday, you could win £100,000. Now, that was a huge amount of money. You know, it still is. But the reality was, I remember doing a TV game show on a Sunday night. And TV was still very much capped. And the most I could give away was £3,000. But on radio the next morning, I gave away 100 grand. It's quite weird how that has now switched around. There was a very odd reaction from some of my colleagues who were kind of sniffy about it, going, oh, well, it's not very capital. I remember a bloke saying, it's not very a Capital Radio thing to do, is it really? Because really, we're buying listeners. Well, of course we are. It's a bloody point. Of course we're trying to buy listeners. We're a very rich company. We want more listeners. Therefore, we can get more advertisers and make even more money. And we made it exciting. Scream at 8.15 and all this rubbish. It was a very exciting thing. And people are listening going, oh, my God, she's got one wrong. Oh, God. Oh. I mean, it was very exciting. It was nerve-wrangling stuff, you know. So, yeah, we were buying listeners. You know, every radio station in the world does it now. But we were buying listeners. Of course we were. We bought thousands of them because we were rich and we could afford to do it.
I'll announce the birthday in this envelope. If it matches yours and you can answer the birthday questions, you could win £1,000.
I think we were on a roll then. I loved it. I was really on top of my game. Briggsy and I were at our most creative. And we were kind of left alone, really. I mean, we were in our own world where... I used to say, I come in at 6, Briggsy comes in at 10, he spends all day saying, well, I don't think Chris meant that when he said that, but I wasn't, you know, I didn't go effing and blinding and stuff. I sort of knew my own limitations, my own censorship. I'm thinking, my kids, who were young kids then, were sitting there having breakfast. So I am not going to do anything that's going to shock them or horrify them or make their mums go, oh, I can't really explain what the man on the radio said. I would never do that stuff. I don't see the point of it. I never went to a meeting before the radio show in my life. I remember Briggsy and I did a tour of American breakfast shows and the suits were in at 4 a.m. shouting abuse at their disc jockeys or trying to G them up or whatever. I never did that in my life. So they come in at you know, for a 6 o'clock show start off, probably 5:30 in America, they would be doing a meeting from 4. And then at 10 when they finish, they'd have another bloody meeting, looking back on what they did wrong, what they did right, what they're going to do tomorrow. That is nonsense. There's just nonsense. You know, the human body can only take so much information. Well, I always reckon if I was parked up when the news jingle was playing, I was all right. And I would literally just fire a jingle. Chris Darren, 6 o'clock in the morning, fire a jingle, play a record, and then basically, what the hell are we going to do today? And I know it sounds very lazy, and probably was, in fact, it definitely was. But I knew the other side of town, Wogan, was doing exactly the same thing. Kenny Everett, bless him. I'm not here yet. This is a recording. I'm still stuck on the Westway in bloody traffic and all this. And they were brilliant, because he used to make those at home and put all his jingles in. So they're actually more fun than listening to Kenny's real show when he arrived. I mean, it was a very different world, but I don't... All right, I don't hear through my radios the improvements at these constant meetings now with disc jockeys. You know, I don't hear any sign of any great achievements that have been made by boring bloody meetings. I don't see the point of it. Where it's beautiful is this whole thing away from suits and analysis and graphs and micromanagement. And that's why radio's fun. Radio at its best is just this wonderful laid-back world. And you do some of the great radio broadcasters are not people you necessarily like at all. You know, you can love your DJ, you can hate your DJ, he can become your best friend, your mate. Oh, I bet, you know, me and him would be have such a great time if we ever had a beer. You could also absolutely hate them, really dislike them, but never turn them off. My dear old father-in-law, bless him, who died at the age of 96 or something, he listened to Brian Hayes on LBC for something like 20 years, hating him so deeply he couldn't switch him off. He used to say to me, did you hear what he said this morning? And I go, no, Jimmy, what did he say? Oh, the bastard. He said, I've got a good mind to go down there and hit him with my stick. But he never missed a programme. He loved it in a bizarre, masochistic way.
We will equip you for the day ahead. The news and the people who make the news, the most accurate weather information on radio. News about money, sport, entertainment, and everything else that touches your life. It's all...
I love the whole individuality of radio. And I think that's... I mean, that is why Radio 2 is continuing to dominate the world of radio, which is sad because it's not that good, but it's much better than most of the commercial opposition now. I'm still vaguely linked to the business. A lot of my friends are in the business. Very few people could tell you more than two or three commercial radio presenters across the whole of the UK now. And that's terrible. You know, everybody knew every DJ on Capital. From before I was there, people like Mike Aspel, Dave Cash, Kenny Everett, Roger Scott, etc., etc. Commercial radio now has become so tediously anonymous and repetitive. I think it's a disaster, you know, and they're getting stuffed by Radio 2 because it's wonderful personality. Oh, listen to him, listen to her, whatever, you know. They may not continue, but at the moment they are dominant. And also because you go, God, I haven't heard this record for a while. As opposed to, well, they always play this one at 8:05, don't they? And the jingles sound the same, and the package sounds the same. I mean, the one shining light at the moment in London is fortuitously the one my son is working on, which is Radio X. And it's more like good fun radio, where there's a wonderful mix of music and really quirky, irritating DJs, including my own son, or Chris Moore's or whatever, you know, but it's a good listen.
Toby Tarrant.
This is Who Wants To Be A Millionaire. I've got Dominic Byrne here.
Hello.
keep it going, it's really bad, I'm so sorry. He's in the hot seat, and we're going to ask him a couple of questions. a couple of what? Questions. Dominic, I'm about to play a song. It is by...
I was thrilled when Toby got a radio job. I mean, I was just thrilled. And he said to me, he said, what do you think? And I said, well, I'll tell you this now. If you only... I suspect you'll do more, but if you only do radio in your life, you will just have the best fun. You will meet so many nice people. You will get a chance to interview all sorts of people, you know, your heroes, and you'll love it. I let him fly now. Occasionally I will say, so I don't listen to him every day, of course I don't, but I dip in and out, and I'm very proud of what he's doing. I think he's doing very well. He's so perfect for that Radio X. He's so perfect for working with guys like Moyles and Co. You know, he fits in. He's quite anarchic like his dad, and he likes that. But he also has restraints. He loves his music. I don't know. I hope he doesn't get lost in the sort of the format side of radio. I don't know at the moment whether there are many stations who could use the potential of my son without cramping his style.
Hello.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning, Chris Tarrant.
Good morning, who are you?
I'm Peter Chase from Isleworth.
Peter Chase from Isleworth. What do you do, Peter Chase?
I'm a company accountant.
You're a what?
A company accountant.
Hey, listen, I cannot give an account of 50,000 pounds.
Oh, yes,
you're mad.
You can. Speak to my wife.
No, absolutely. I don't want to speak to your wife. I never talked to
you. I got tired. And once Millionaire started as well, I was working silly hours. Domestically, it wasn't great. I was having a lot of problems at home because I was away all the time and all that. I was earning a huge amount of money, but the rest of my life wasn't great. Something's got to give. And although I've had a great time on radio, and I probably preferred radio, I really think I just want to stop getting out of bed. I used to come home from Millionaire about midnight one and then get up again at five and all that. So I thought, I will say to them, look, guys, we've had a good run. We've all, you know, made lots of money and the company's going through the roof, etc., etc. But I really think next year I want to leave. And it's like, you can't do that. The share price will slump. And I think, hang on, this is not my problem, man. But it actually, you know, it actually was like that. And there would be questions. David Mansfield, bless him, who was the CEO of the whole of Capital, you know, that period, the very successful money-making period. He would go to the city and the first, well, what's Chris Tarrant's contract? Well, how long's your contract for? You think David was sort of bluff and whatever. Well, is he going to renew it? I mean, this is nonsense. It's a bloke playing records and talking crap. That's all you do. It was bizarre. So I was like a commercial commodity. But it is what happens in America. You know, if Rick Dees leaves Kiss Los Angeles, whatever, there'd be, you know, public outcry. And it does affect money and profits and stuff. I never wanted to undermine. I mean, I loved Capital. I was hugely proud of their achievements, you know, in terms of the audience, the way people love the programmes, the way people love the DJs, the presenters. I loved every aspect of that. So I thought, I don't want to rock the boat, but in the end, I'm knackered. People always say to me, it's a game, you're just trying to get your money out. I'm saying I'm not. I've actually stopped getting, I got paid very well. But in the end, I was negotiating more holidays. You know, I think I ended up with about, I don't know, 16 weeks a year or something, which again undermines it, because it's like, well, that's too much, you know, too much time off. Richard Park was always very good, which a lot of them are. A lot of the controllers are not good at all about their presenters doing telly and stuff. He was very good with me from the way before Millionaire. You know, he said, I like that. I like my presenters to be, you know, nationally known and all that stuff. And he was always very good about that.
6 minutes past 6 o'clock. I still haven't paid Jamelia this morning. I've done 6 minutes. Are we queuing up Spinner's Groove yet? No, apparently not.
For weeks before, I kept playing, it's the final countdown. Briggsy would go, stop playing that, stop it. I said, it's a great record, you play it every day. But it is, whatever it was, my leaving day was somewhere like April the 5th or something. It's the final countdown and all that. I do remember David Mansfield, which I thought was wonderful. He said, obviously, Chris is leaving on Friday of this week after years of service to the company. And we're all very sad that he's going. And I personally asked him not to go. But, you know, we respect his decision. It does mean, when he's leaving on Friday, that from Monday, all budgets across the station will be hugely increased. Every disc jockey will get a lot more money because there's so much money we've saved by not employing the bastard Tarrant. And everyone cheered. I thought that was cool.
For some reason this morning, the producer seems to have done them all about me. I've woken up on a mainline railway train from Wolverhampton to Birmingham, dressed only in pants and one sock.
I can believe that.
Stop it. Or I presented a news item on Birmingham local TV news, ITV, as we used to
The last day entirely was really odd. I mean, I went in with a great spring in my stride, thinking the last time I do this. By the end, I got quite sad. And some of the guys, and this doesn't happen on TV, some of the guys, I mean, real hard-nosed engineers and things, came into me and sort of holding me and crying. I'm thinking, it's only a bit of radio, mate, and I can still see you next week in the pub, sort of thing. And I still, this is really strange, I have somewhere a huge file of my last day on The Breakfast Show's emails from listeners. And I read one, and it really kind of struck a chord and actually really got to me. and I've never read the others. It made me very sad, and I thought, this is like somebody's life. Is like, and you think, no, it's not. I mean, it's a bit of radio, mate. It was weird how huge an impression a breakfast show can make on people's lives. Not just mine, lots of others. My missus came in, my kids all came in, you know. They sort of felt they got their daddy back, which was nice.
Capital Breakfast, 2nd of April, 2004. Do you know, when I'd done 1 year, Nigel Walmsley, a rather odd man who then ran the company...
Yes.
He said to me, it's gone really well, Chris. I'm really pleased with the breakfast show.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no. And he said, let's extend your contract. And I said, well, that's very nice, thank you. I said, how long? And he said, well, actually, in America, he said, well, they have a thing, and I'd quite like to think about this, where you sign for 10 years.
Really?
I'm saying to Nigel, if you think I'm going to still be getting out of bed in 1998, you want your bumps ready. 25 to 8.
Tarrant, in the morning.
So much stuff on Millionaire came out of radio. The big pause thing, that all came from radio. Just me and Briggsy. One morning, I knew the name of the winner. By then, it was about 9:45 or something. And I said, find out who's won £100,000 after the break. And we went to break, and he went, God, that's brilliant. Oh. 2 years later, whatever, I go, find out whether this man's just won £1 million or not after the break. They do it now on every programme, on ITV, BBC, whatever. The pause thing, I hate to say it, I mean, some bloke ranting against me in the Standard, but he's quite right. I did it first on Bonanza, and it was Dave. You just won £100,000. All that. It was thought to be very unkind and unnecessarily teasing and whatever. I think at the end, just ask this guy, he's just £100,000. I think he's quite happy, actually. I did it on Millionaire, but it was then Anton Deck do it, Strictly Come Dancing. They all do it on everything. You know, Theresa May.
Result of the ballot held this evening is that the Parliamentary Party does have confidence. Yeah.
You're still Prime Minister. I mean, it's just unreal. Phone a friend's sort of obvious one. I came up with that thing where you show someone a cheque and you go, it's a cheque for £50,000. But we don't want to give you that. I was in Leicester last year. I was gasping for a pint. Sunny August, I think, lunchtime. I came to a pub on the outskirts of Leicester. I thought, I've got to have a beer. I don't care if they all, you know me or not. I don't mind meeting people at all, but the phone a friend thing. I mean, every day of my life, literally, already this morning, I've already had one. Phone a friend! So I go into this pub in Leicester. The landlord just sort of looks at me, glowering. I said, pint of lager, please. So he pours this pint up. And you know that thing when you're absolutely gasping for a beer and your tongue is dry and you think, I want this beer so badly. And he got right to the top. And I thought, I'm just about to drink that any second now. And as he got there, he went, we don't want to give you that, and poured it in the slop bucket. What an arse! And the whole pub laughed and we all laughed or whatever. It is bizarre, that stuff. Final answer just came out of, I had to give the director's box upstairs who were watching a sign, this man cannot, or woman, cannot go on, you know, I think it might be A, then again it could be B and all that. I had to give them sort of signs. So I thought, we've got to do something. So we'll just come up with this phrase, meaning, is that your final answer? Yes. The moment they say yes, there's a ding and it goes to orange and that's how it works. There's a wonderful bloke in Japan who is the host of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire in Japan? And Frank Skinner showed me a tape of this bloke. I mean, I do the pause. Well, I did the pause for sort of something like 10 seconds. If I say, is that your final answer? Final answer. I just think I've done 3 seconds. This bloke does about... Because no country's allowed to deviate from the original Who Wants to Be a Millionaire format. The Japanese would prefer to do it with live snakes going down your trousers and electrodes being applied to your testicles, but they can't do that. So this bloke does what he can. He goes, so, final answer. Yeah, final answer. And then he just sits and stares at them for anything up to a minute, which is an incredibly long time. And the contestant is going, oh, my God, oh, oh. Best fun was definitely radio. Definitely. Tiz was wonderful time. Millionaire obviously was a hugely successful programme, and I was very proud to be involved with it and be there at the beginning of it and all that, and we all made lots of money. But in terms of just crack with mates, 17 years in the dark on the radio in the morning was the best fun. It did attract the sort of the biggest buzz, I suppose, because there is this thing, you do dominate a city as their main morning man or whatever. I mean, I see, funnily enough, I'm going to have a long meal with them today, but I see my old mates, you know, all from Capital, who are now, some of them still there, some of them are scattered all around the place. I see those socially now more than any of my other working mates. The great thing about radio, you can actually have a good idea driving in with one eye sort of half open at 10 to 6, think, I think I'll do that today. You do it at 6:15, and by 6:25, you think, that was a stupid idea, I'm not doing that again, or whatever. But that wonderful instant buzz. And you cannot do a meeting before the show to me, to Terry Wogan, to Kenny Everett. You know, you can't. And the best sort of radio comes out of people's instincts, just saying, that would be great. Chris Tarrant in the morning. 95.8 Capital FM. I sort of miss being on radio, the actual physical thing of putting your headphones on and all that. But I don't actually. I have a really nice life now. I've worked very hard over years. I know I don't work very hard. I just do a few bits of telly, and it's away from. I spend an awful lot of my time in studios. So filming around the world, you know, since I did the railway thing, I've been to the Congo, I've been to Bolivia, Australia, India, Japan, whatever. I've been everywhere, Siberia. I've been everywhere. So I've enjoyed that, but it's not actually. In terms of, you know, my life, it takes me 6 weeks a year or whatever, which means lots of time to enjoy my missus, my kids, my life, to go fishing. I travel a lot, and I enjoy that, and I enjoy going to new countries and seeing the world. I can't fit a radio show into that. You know, I can't juggle my life. I mean, somebody said to me, the best thing you could do, my son said this to me, actually, had this conversation the other day. He is becoming a very nearly average radio broadcaster, nearly. He said, what you ought to do, Dad, is make a radio show, get your records, get your links, do it all, and it never goes out. And then you'd be happy. And I went, you know, I actually would. I'd been filming in Bolivia, and it was a tough old schedule, but, you know, I've done lots of tough schedules over the years. I spoke to my missus early in the morning. She said, hi, darling, I'm about to get a flight out of Bangkok in about an hour. See you tonight. She said, oh, great, I'll be waiting for you, and whatever. I felt fine, actually. I sat in the lounge in Bangkok airport, bit of coffee and some sort of dreadful-looking bacon concoction. And as I sat waiting to just get on the plane, I just sort of slid off my chair. And my leg went funny. I thought, what? And a bloke next to me said, you all right, Chris? I said, no, I feel a bit strange, actually. I said, I think it's a bit of cramp and I've been working. He said, you sure? I said, yeah, I'm fine. Got on the plane, settled myself down in sort of business class. It was mainly dark. And after about half an hour, I thought, oh, my leg's bloody weird. And the leg sort of really went stiff. And then I noticed my right arm was also, like, staying down. I thought, God, this is strange. And I thought, I'm just, you know, I'll get home, I'll be all right. And then it went. And I thought, that's all right, nothing to worry about. You know, I genuinely thought a bit of cramp. And I remember I went to the loo. And I was feeling fine at that time. I went to the loo. And when I came out, I literally almost fell down. And I'm sort of clawing along the seats. I got back to my seat and sort of sat down. I thought, I think I might be having a stroke. And I could hear my voice really slurring, like, thank you or something. And then it sort of went again. And then I got frightened and I thought, I could actually die up here. And because I'm very British, I didn't want to make a fuss. It's a pathetic British thing we have. You know, I've seen those things where they say the plane was put down. I'm over somewhere like Afghanistan. You know, on my way to Iraq, thinking, where do I want to be put down here for the finest local hospital? And I just want to get home. And I was getting panicky. And then again, it sort of went, and my arm started working again and whatever. And when we landed, I remember standing up, thinking, oh, good, I can get my bag. And I got my bag down from the overhead locker. And then I started to walk off the plane, and I had a sort of strange sort of sailor's gait, which I was very aware of. And then people were sort of passing me, looking at me oddly. And then I just keeled over. And I just sort of, you know, I was conscious, but I just keeled over. And Heathrow, I have maligned shamefully over many years, they were fantastic. A paramedic came out of nowhere, you know, bloke arrived on a bicycle going through all the crowds, but he had all the gear and said, yeah, you've had a stroke. And two very nice police women arrived. They said, right, where's your missus, where's your driver? And I said, they're through. So they went through and told them, and I got an ambulance, and I mean, they were great, and they rushed me to hospital and all that. Rushed in, very nice man called Dr. Sharma, who I probably owe my life to. And I remember the next morning, my missus came and went about three times during the night, and then my kids all trooped in, which is horrible. I just thought, no, I'm usually like the strong one, and I felt really... And my daughter, Jen, was sitting beside the bed. I said, how are you feeling now, Dad? And I said, I just can't lift this bloody arm. My right arm just wouldn't go up. If you survive, which, you know, mercifully and very luckily I did, you have to teach yourself things. I mean, I remember this wonderful physio guy came, huge big black guy, and he started throwing a football at me, and I couldn't catch it. Now, I've done sports all my life, you know, I'm a very good slip fielder, you know, and suddenly I can't catch a football from 3 yards, it's pathetic. And my arms are doing sort of comic things. And slowly, he retaught me to teach my brain how to catch. I am very lucky. I've presented the Stroke Awards the last couple of years, and I realised how lucky I was. And when I left, I mean, I was in hospital for about 3 weeks. I had about 6 months speech therapy. This wonderful girl, because I'm sort of going, and all these strange movements with your mouth, because obviously my mouth is a major part of my earning my living. I think initially, I just wanted to survive. And then I thought, well, I'm all right, you know. My speech is all right, but it's not perfect. So I had about 6 months of speech therapy. I remember I'd written the book about my dad, and I thought, I really want to be able to publicise this, because, you know, it was all written and done, but I wanted to be available. I think I had the stroke in March, and I wanted to be available to do, like, the promotional tour of television, radio stations and all that by May. I just remember there was a date in the diary to do the one show. And I said to this speech girl, I said, I want to do the one show on May the 12th or whatever. She said, you're nowhere near ready for that. I said, I know, but that's what I'm working towards. She said, it's good, give yourself a goal and we'll try and get there. But, you know, you can always pull out at the last minute. I said, no, I can. You know, they would understand and all that, but... So I did the one show, and I was absolutely fine.
Dad's War is my new book. It's all about my father, who was my best friend, talked to me about everything except his war. He was a hero, and I knew absolutely nothing about him.
Mum and Dad were very wary of the big bad world of television, fame, showbiz, whatever you call it. I think that was probably quite a natural reaction. Bear in mind as well, I mean... 1970s when I started, it was all quite new, you know. I mean, I'd done a year's teaching in New Cross, which is pretty grim. In fact, it was awful. And I think Mum's attitude was always, well, you can always go back to teaching, which she used to say. And I go, Mum, I've done Tis Wars. I couldn't possibly go back to teaching. And then I think when I started doing the news and stuff, they thought that was all right. They thought Tis Wars was kind of manic. But then they thought, this is actually quite fun. This is our kid doing something he's enjoying. So they used to come up, quite often they come up on a Saturday lunchtime and sit and have a drink with me and Lenny Henry with custard in our hair or whatever. And I think they were always wary about the uncertainty of the business. They probably did understand that I couldn't really go back to teaching. I think Dad was worried after I left Tis Wars, and when I did OTT, certainly there was a lot of flack, which he'd never read before or had to read before, because there wasn't much before that. So he felt for his son. He was very defensive on me, sort of publicly, but I think he thought, God, this is going to go wrong, and my kid at the age of 30 or whatever could be out of work. And then I did radio, like the Capital thing started, and he quite liked all that. He was hugely proud of Millionaire, which is impossible not to be proud of. If your son's doing that, it's pretty damn good. So it was fine. He was very supportive always. Even when I think once or twice he must have thought, I'm not sure about that, mate, you know. I mean, I don't think he likes certain aspects of OTT. Shockingly rude and occasionally foul language from someone like Alexis Sale or Bernard Manning or whatever. But no, he was very, very supportive, always. Do you know, I haven't got a single regret in my life. I think there are one or two things I should regret, and I actually don't. That sounds terrible, but the good bits so outweigh the bad bits. you know, that I just think I have had such a lucky ride. I have interviewed all my heroes, Elton John, Paul McCartney. David Bowie was the nicest human being I've ever met. And he went, hello, mate, Tarrant, isn't it? How are you? David Bowie came in with no entourage, you know. He is a god. Came on the radio with me, just me and him in the studio, did an hour. And he said, what do you want me to do? And I said, well, can we do some calls, put some calls? He said, yeah, talk to anybody. So this bloke came, I've always remembered this bloke came, I said, hello, Dave. I remember seeing you once on the 102 bus coming out of Camberwell. And Bowie said, yeah, I remember, I used to use that a lot. And then I used to get another one sometimes from Thornton Heath going down to Streatham. And all these people rang up saying, yeah, and I saw you on the bus, you know, in sort of New Cross. And this whole hour was sort of people talking about David Bowie, you know, Ziggy sitting on a bus. I was so pleased and thrilled to just be there steering these conversations. I've had a great time. I love the radio years. I still some of my best friends are, you know, those I made in the Capital years. But no, I've been very lucky and I've had a real buzz. I would like people... He used to smile at a time when I didn't really feel like smiling. Because I think that is good. If you're sitting there in the dark, in your car, going to work on a horrible road, in a traffic jam, you know, with a boss you hate, probably for the next 30 years, for crap money, and a bloke makes you smile a bit, I think that's good.